for Liz to argue with her, to threaten to turn her in. But Liz just said, okay, let's follow this line of thinking. Where will you go? Eva shrugged. I'll stay in New York for a while, find a way to get a fake passport. I have money. Liz nodded. A fake passport. And then you'll leave the country. Eva knew what Liz was doing. She'd had a professor at Berkeley use this kind of Socratic method to help students reason out an argument. But she went along with it. Yes. Liz rolled her glass between her hands, the ice settling toward the bottom. You'll be someone new, someone without a past. What will you do with your time? Will you work, buy some property, rent? How will you explain yourself to others? I'll figure it out, make something up, and constantly be afraid, looking over your shoulder, waiting for someone to discover the truth. Liz's quiet voice landed hard in Eva's ears. You need to make a deal, and you need to do it now. Liz set her glass down and put her finger under Eva's chin, forcing Eva to look at her. What happened to you was shitty and unfair, but you have to go back and own your part of it. Either Dex is going to jail for a long time, or you are. Who's it going to be? And what if Dex's people get to me first? He has to know by now. Panic began to swirl around inside of Eva, and she started to cry again. Liz handed her a tissue and said, you have to fly back before Castro knows you left. Call him the minute you land and wait for him at the airport. Do not leave until he comes in to get you, understand? Why can't I just disappear? Eva whispered. Pretend I've never been here. Liz's eyes softened. You know they'll come here eventually and ask me questions. I can't lie for you. Maybe this was why Eva came. To be forced to do the right thing. To be held accountable by someone who loved her enough to not let her make any more mistakes. For Liz to be the mother she'd never had. Relief melted through her. To be able to set everything down and let someone else, someone who cared about her, tell her what to do. Okay, she said. They sat together, with only the faint ticking of a clock somewhere deep inside the house. The silence between them heavy with all that Eva still wanted to say. All her life, she'd craved connection, family, friendship. Then Liz came along and gave it to her, without asking for anything in return. Eva wanted to ask, why me? But she wouldn't, because there could never be enough words to fill the hole Eva had inside of her, the deepest part of the heart, where the most precious love and the truest friendships are stored. She knew that walking out the door tomorrow would require an act of courage Eva wasn't sure she possessed. To turn her back and leave this life, with all its sharp edges and hard knots, and trust that there would be something on the other side for her. Do you remember the day we met? Liz's voice was the same low tenor Eva remembered from their first meeting, and it passed through her like warm honey. I was crumpled in a heap on the ground, and you walked over and lifted me up. Eva started to speak, but Liz silenced her with an upheld hand. Do not ever forget who you are and what you mean to me. In a world crowded with noise and selfishness, you are a brilliant flash of kindness. Liz turned Eva so she was facing her and held her by the shoulders. No matter where you go, no matter what happens, know I will be out here, loving you. Eva let her tears fall, the last of her walls crumbling beneath Liz's words. Every regret, every disappointment, every heartache that Eva had ever endured seeped out of her, a slow leak of sadness, until she was empty. After she'd booked her flight back to Oakland, they sat together on the couch, Eva trying to soak up every last moment with Liz, knowing it would never be enough. From the front of the house came the sound of a key in the lock, then the door opening and closing. "Mom?" a voice called. "Are you home?" "Back here, honey." A young woman came through the kitchen, tossing her keys on the counter and dropping her heavy bag on the floor. She pulled up short when she saw Eva and Liz on the couch. "Sorry," she said. "I didn't know you had company." "Eva, this is my daughter, Ellie." Ellie rolled her eyes and stepped forward to shake Eva's hand. "I go by Danielle now. It's nice to finally meet you."
Claire, Monday, February 28th. I stare at him, feeling as if the ground has shifted beneath my feet. I don't know who that is. Agent Castro flips his sunglasses on top of his head and says, "I think you do. You just finished a call on her phone." My eyes dart toward Eva's cell phone sitting on the dresser, wondering how he'd know that. He continues, "So let's try this a different way. Good afternoon, Mrs. Cook. It's wonderful to see you looking so well. My name is Agent Castro, and I'm a federal DEA officer. I have some questions I'd like to ask you." Behind him in the parking lot is an anonymous sedan with government plates. "Maybe we should go inside and chat," he suggests. His tone is friendly but firm, and I nod, opening the door wider to let him enter. We sit at the small table, by the window, two chairs facing each other. He pulls the curtains open, flooding the tiny room with light. "I'd like to know how you know Eva James."
"I don't, really."
"And yet, up until yesterday, you were staying at her house." He gestures toward Eva's green coat, tossed over a chair.
"And wearing her clothes."
Then he holds up his own phone.
"Mrs. Cook, we've had Ms. James under surveillance for several months. That includes having her phone cloned."
"Cloned?" I ask. "What does that mean?" He leans back and studies me, the weight of his gaze making me uncomfortable. Finally, he says,
"It means that anything you do with that phone, we know about it. We get copies of all texts and emails. When that phone rings, we know it. Whatever is said on it, we hear it."
My mind jumps back to the conversation I just had with Kate Lane, to Danielle's messages, and the voice recording. And I know now why Eva left the phone behind.
"Did she know?"
He shakes his head.
"She was working with us on an active investigation, and we couldn't risk her changing her patterns with the people she worked with. But we began to worry when Eva failed to show up at a prearranged meeting last week. And then you arrived."
I look down at my hands resting in my lap. I think about the car Kate Lane is sending for me and whether Agent Castro will let me get in it or whether I'm going to be stuck here answering his questions until the moment Rory arrives.
"Why don't we start with how you met Eva?" he repeats.
If you've been listening in on my phone conversations, then you already know.
"Fair enough. Then tell me more about what happened at the airport. Whose idea was it to switch places?"
I'm unsure how to describe my role. Am I a victim? A co-conspirator? I was neither, just a woman desperate for a solution, any solution. "Eva approached me," I finally say. Castro nods.
"How did she seem to you?"
That's an impossible question to answer since nothing she told me was true. I think of the way she stared into her drink, as if the weight of the world rested on her shoulders, and know that beneath her lies, the fear was real. "She was scared," I finally say.
"She had a good reason to be. Did anyone come to the house looking for her?"
I tell him about the man who showed up on the porch, about what he said and what he didn't say.
"Describe him,"
Agent Castro says. "About my age, maybe a little bit older. Dark hair, olive skin, long coat, and these crazy gray eyes, not quite blue."
"While you were staying at Eva's house, did you see any drugs?"
"No." I think about that basement lab, of the hours Eva must have spent working underground, and what it had cost her up above. And I think about the notarized letter and recordings, carefully gathered and documented. and weigh the benefits of handing them over now. If I do, Castro will have what he needs, or as much as Eva is able to give him, which might be enough to fulfill whatever promises she made. I retrieve the envelope and voice recorder and slide them across the table to him. I found these yesterday when I discovered her basement. He sets the recorder aside and flips through the pages of Eva's statement, then jots the notary information into a small notebook. I had no idea what she was running from. She told me she had just lost her husband to cancer, that she'd helped him die and that she might be in trouble because of it. As I recount the story, it sounds even crazier than it did at the time. You have to understand, I was desperate enough to want to believe pretty much anything. And I think she knew that.
Eva has had years of practice deceiving people. She's very good at what she does. She had to be, to have done it for so long.
He leans forward, resting his elbows on the table.
I need you to understand that my job is to investigate drug crimes, he says. Not fraud, not identity theft, and you are not under investigation by me.
His voice softens now that his questions have been answered, and I get a peek at the man beneath the surface, someone who genuinely wants to help me.
I understand you're hiding from your husband.
I am.
I'm not here to get you into trouble, Mrs. Cook, but Eva was helping me, and I need to know what happened to her. What she told you.
Nothing true, I say. None of it was real. He looks out the window as a black town car glides into the spot next to his sedan.
I think your ride is here.
We stand, and I open the door.
Claire Cook? The driver asks.
He's large, in his mid-20s, squeezed into a dark suit with sleeves that just barely cover a tattoo circling up his right wrist. In his ears are those giant circles, stretching enormous holes in his earlobes. Berkeley, where everyone is just a little bit weirder than you are. As he loads my bag into the trunk, I notice his gaze land on Agent Castro's gun beneath his coat. He looks away and slams the trunk closed, stepping away from the rest of our conversation. Agent Castro stands in front of his driver's side door.
Good luck, he says, shaking my hand. If possible, I'd like to touch base again before you leave town, assuming you go back to New York.
Sure, I say, looking toward the busy street, cars and buses blowing past the motel. Though what happens next depends on the next few hours, how much trouble I'll be in for what I did, and whether anyone will believe what I have to say.
If your husband was involved in what happened to Maggie Moretti, it won't matter if they believe you or not. The evidence will back you up.
I tear my eyes away from the street and look at him.
You don't know the Cook family very well, if you think they won't fight. The rules are different for people like them.
I wait for Agent Castro to tell me I'm wrong, but he doesn't. Even he knows that the power of money can make all kinds of problems disappear. Finally, he says,
A little advice? Get on the air as soon as possible. Your husband can't touch you if the whole world knows you're alive.
Traffic into the city is horrible. We progress slowly through the toll booth and up onto the Bay Bridge, walled in on all sides by cars. Alone in the back seat, I stare out the window, my gaze traveling across the water and landing on Alcatraz, small and squat in the middle of the bay, the slate gray water surrounding it. The driver adjusts the rearview mirrors so he can see me better, his sleeve riding up even higher, and I catch another glimpse of his tattooed arm.
Okay if I turn on the radio? He asks.
Sure, I tell him.
He flips around until he lands on some quiet jazz. I pull Eva's phone out of my purse to check the time and see that I have a missed text from Danielle.
I just found out that Mr. Cook's already got a guy on the ground in Berkeley looking for you. A local. Someone who can better blend in with the people there. But I'm told he's big, with a tattoo sleeve on his right arm. Be careful.
Eva, New Jersey, February, one day before the crash. Ellie, or rather Danielle, did not look as Eva had expected Liz's daughter to look. Instead of the eclectic woman she'd imagined, a woman who wore long flowing skirts and worked for a hardscrabble nonprofit, Danielle had her dark hair pulled back into a conservative bun at the base of her neck, She wore pearls and a tailored suit with low heels. But the resemblance between mother and daughter was immediate. Danielle had the small stature of her mother, the planes of her face, an almost mirror image of the friend Eva had grown to love. But where Liz was calm and centered, Danielle seemed agitated. Liz stood to give her daughter a kiss. "Are you just getting home from work? It's late." Ignoring her mother's question, Danielle said to Eva, "I didn't know you were coming to town." The way Danielle said it, like an accusation, rumbled low inside of Eva, warning her to be careful. "A last-minute trip," she said. "In and out." "Because?" Danielle's gaze held Eva's. "Because she wanted to," Liz interjected, throwing a warning glare at her daughter. "A quick visit to see some friends," Eva said, hoping to diffuse some of the tension. "I have to head back tomorrow." Danielle waited a moment, as if to see if Eva would offer more details. When she didn't, Danielle said, "Mom, can I see you in the other room?" Apologetic, Liz turned to Eva. "Make yourself comfortable. I'll be back in a minute." The two women huddled in the living room, the sound of their whispered conversation floating back to Eva in snatches. She rose from the couch and wandered into the kitchen under the pretense of looking at the pictures on the refrigerator. "What is the matter with you?" Liz hissed. "I'm sorry. I'm exhausted and stressed, and I've still got to pack for a trip to Detroit tomorrow," Danielle said. "I wasn't expecting a house guest." "What's happening in Detroit?" "The foundation has an event there tomorrow. I was supposed to accompany Mrs. Cook, but I just found out Mr. Cook is sending her to Puerto Rico instead. He wants to do the Detroit trip himself." Danielle sighed. "I'm sorry to be so snappy with you, but this last-minute itinerary change is making me edgy. Something feels off."
"In what way?"
"Mrs. Cook has been singularly focused on this trip for months. In a way, that's unusual for her. It's a school the Cook Family Foundation supports, but she zeroed in on it months ago."
"I think you're working too hard, worrying about things that aren't there."
Liz's voice sounded soothing, and Eva imagined her taking Danielle's hand and squeezing it.
"I don't think so, Mom. There's been other weird stuff. Her driver told me last month she took the car, alone, to Long Island. The GPS tracked her all the way to the eastern tip. She doesn't know anyone who lives out there. And I've had to cover for her a few times with financial discrepancies, withdrawals, receipts that don't match."
Eva could hear the worry in Danielle's voice, the tension of watching and waiting for something to happen.
"I think she's going to leave him."
"Good, finally."
"Yeah, but I don't think the Puerto Rico trip is a part of that. And I'm worried the Detroit trip was."
"Do you think Mr. Cook knows?"
"No, but if this messes her up somehow."
She trailed off.
"I don't like the idea of her traveling alone or with people only loyal to the incredible Rory Cook. And now I've got to go to Detroit and act as if I'm one of them, when I can barely stand to look at the man knowing how he terrorizes her."
"If she's smart, she'll go to Puerto Rico and never come back."
Eva had stopped pretending to look at the pictures and was now entirely focused on listening to this story unfold, piecing together the bare bones of an idea. In two steps, she was across the kitchen and over to the couch, grabbing her laptop and setting it up on the counter so she could still listen in. As the two women continued to talk, Eva Googled Rory Cook, wife, and studied the image that appeared. A beautiful woman, her dark hair framing her face, wearing high-end, trendy clothes, walking down a New York sidewalk. The caption read, "Rory Cook's wife, Claire, visits the new restaurant Entourage, located on the Upper West Side." In the next room, Danielle said,
"Somehow, I don't think staying in Puerto Rico is an option for her. I feel terrible that she has to go, that she's going to wake up and Bruce is going to be the one to tell her of the change, that he'll be the one to take her to JFK.
With an impatient sigh, she continued,
"Anyways, I'm sorry I was rude to Eva. I'm sure she's lovely. What's the real story? Why is she really in town?"
Eva held her breath, staring at the details of Claire Cook's face, but not seeing them anymore.
Instead, she waited to hear whether Liz would keep her secrets or reveal them all, dishing them up to her daughter like a late-night snack. Eva's hit a rough patch, Liz said, but she's going to be fine. She's a survivor. Eva let out a quiet sigh of relief. Look, Danielle was saying, I need to pack since we're leaving at the crack of dawn. Do you know where my black wool coat is? Upstairs in the spare bedroom closet, I think. Let me see if I can find it. Thanks, Mom. Such a simple sentence, probably uttered hundreds of thousands of times. And yet, the power of it nearly brought Eva to tears. What it must be like to have someone always in your corner. She thought she'd had that with Liz. But seeing her together with her daughter, the way they trusted and confided in each other, Eva knew what she and Liz shared was nothing more than a close friendship. And she felt stupid for ever thinking it was more. What would Liz advise her daughter to do if she found herself in Eva's position? Would she also encourage Danielle to turn herself in to the authorities? Or would she help her daughter escape? On the screen in front of her, she imagined what Claire Cook would think tomorrow, when she woke to discover her husband had changed her itinerary, that she'd be flying out of JFK to a tropical paradise instead of into the freezing Detroit temperatures. Perhaps she wouldn't care. Perhaps Danielle's instincts about the importance of this trip were wrong. But if they were right, if Claire was planning to run, she'd find herself desperate for a solution, another way out. And Eva might just have the solution in mind. What are you doing? Eva whipped around to find Danielle in the doorway, holding the bag she'd dropped there earlier. Eva closed the lid of the computer, hoping Danielle hadn't seen too much, and gave her a blank smile. Nothing. She held Danielle's gaze until Danielle finally turned away, up the stairs to pack for her trip. Eva opened the laptop again and toggled away from the photograph of Claire Cook and over to the airline website. She clicked on Change My Reservation, and in the drop-down menu, she switched out Newark for JFK, Liz's words echoing in her mind. She's a survivor. Eva was determined to make that true.
Claire, Monday, February 28th. I press my back into the seat, my gaze leaping from Danielle's text to the driver's right hand, resting casually on the steering wheel, a tattoo sleeve on his right arm. My mind flies back to the motel lot and realize he hadn't said anything about CNN. He'd said Claire Cook, and like an idiot, I got in the car. Vehicles press in on us all the way to the edge of the bridge. Steel cables rise into the sky above a small strip of sidewalk, and then a 500-foot drop to the cold water below. Castro's advice, to get to the studio as soon as possible, taunts me now. This man will take me somewhere else, a deserted beach, perhaps. Or north to somewhere even more remote, and finish this. A green Jetta slides up next to us with a woman behind the wheel, her lips moving in silent conversation with someone I can't see. I'm no more than 3 feet away from her, so close I can see her pink nail polish and the delicate silver hoops in her ears. I fight back tears, trying to think, if I screamed, would she hear me? Our car moves several feet forward before stopping again, and now I'm looking at a white panel van with no windows. My eyes trace the tiny openings between the cars, an ever-shifting maze as the vehicles inch forward. I'm going to have to jump out and run. The lane next to us begins to move, and I'm looking at the woman in the green Jetta. She throws her head back and laughs, unaware that I'm watching her from behind tinted glass. About 30 yards away, a dark tunnel looms with signs for Treasure Island. The driver's eyes find mine in the rearview mirror. Traffic will clear up once we get through the tunnel, he says. If I'm going to get out, a dark tunnel might be a good place to do it. I rest my arm on the windowsill, my palms sweaty and slick against the door, and carefully lift the lock, watching him in the mirror, making sure his eyes remain on the road. I'm only going to get one chance. Jazz music swirls around the back seat, the rhythm fast and erratic, matching my pulse, and I hug my purse close, making sure it's secure over my shoulder. I have one hand resting on the latch of my seatbelt and my other hand lowering to the door handle, ready to yank it open and leap out. If I scream for help, surely someone will step up. I regulate my breathing, counting down the feet until the car is plunged into the darkness of the tunnel. 20 feet. 10. 5. The driver looks at me again in the mirror.
You okay? He asks. You look a little pale. I have some water up here if you need it. The CNN studio is just a few blocks once we get off the bridge. Not much farther now.
I feel the air rush out of me and collapse against the seat, clasping my shaking hands in my lap. CNN. Not Rory. Dizzy relief floods through me and I squeeze my eyes shut, trying not to fall apart. This is the price of abuse. It has twisted my thinking into such a tangle I can't tell what's real and what's not. Logically, I can see how impossible it would have been for them to find me so easily. And yet, years of being under Rory's influence has made it so that I've given him nearly superhuman power to see where I've hidden, to know my every thought and fear, and then to exploit them. Finally, the car picks up speed and we enter the tunnel. The darkness is a brief blink, and then we're out the other side. As if by magic, the entire city rises up before us, bright white buildings shining in the early afternoon sun.
Mrs. Cook,
he asks again, holding up a small bottle of water. I'm okay, I tell him, as much for myself as for him. Breaking news. We interrupt our regularly scheduled program to bring you Kate Lane, live from Washington, D.C., with a story that is just emerging from California. Kate. The voices talk in my ear, though I sit alone on a stool placed in front of a green screen. Several producers and assistants are clustered around the single camera, zoomed in on me, but the red light indicating that I'm on air remains dark. Next to it, a television screen shows Kate Lane in her DC studio, the feed piped directly into my earpiece. My head is still fuzzy from the adrenaline, but the freezing temperature of the studio clears it a little. On the far wall of the studio is a large digital clock with a bright blue background that reads 1:22. And I watch the seconds tick down, trying to align my heart rate with them. Shortly after I'd arrived at the CNN studio, weak and shaking, a producer had handed me an iPad with Kate Lane calling via video chat. They'd been able to talk with Danielle, who had agreed to send the recording to the New York State Attorney General. Kate's sources inside the department told her they should have some news about the next steps very soon. Charlotte Price had also been located and was willing to go on the record as soon as her attorney could file to void the NDA she'd signed so long ago. So now it's up to you to tell your story, Kate had said. Paint a picture of your marriage for us. Tell us what your husband was like and what you were running from. Her expression softened. I have to prepare you for what will likely happen once you come forward. People are going to dig into your life, your past, say hateful things about you and to you, in a very public way. It won't matter whose side people are on, yours or your husband's. Your life will be put under a microscope regardless. Every choice you ever made, every person you ever talked to, your family, your friends. I have an obligation to make sure you're clear before we proceed. Hearing Kate spell out exactly what I'd feared for so many years made me hesitate, and I considered stepping back, letting Danielle and Charlie's evidence do all the work. No one needed to hear the details of my abuse in order to lay Maggie Moretti's death at Rory's feet. And yet, I knew that if I didn't, I'd be destined to live and relive moments like the one on the bridge. I would never truly be free if I scurried away to hide under another rock. I'd be complicit in Rory's abuse as long as I continued to protect him. The world didn't need to hear my story, but I needed to tell it. I understand, I told her. Live in 5 seconds, someone says. Good evening. Kate's voice fills my earpiece as if she's sitting right next to me. In the last hour, attorneys for Rory Cook, head of the Cook Family Foundation and son of the late Senator Marjorie Cook, have been fielding requests for questioning related to the death of Maggie Moretti, who died 27 years ago on a Cook family property. But even more extraordinary is the fact that authorities received this information via Mr. Cook's wife, previously believed to have perished on Flight 477. CNN has discovered that she is alive and living in California. We have her here now via satellite to discuss the accusations against her husband and why she felt she had to hide. Mrs. Cook, so good to see you. The light on the camera in front of me illuminates, and the director points at me. I fight the urge to reach up and touch my hair, aware of how different I look. Thank you, Kate. It's good to be here. My voice sounds lonely in the empty space, and I try to stay focused on the television monitor that shows a background of the San Francisco skyline behind me. Mrs. Cook, tell us what happened and how you came to be here today. Now that I'm here, I can see that it was always going to come to this. For too long, I believed my voice alone wouldn't be enough, that nobody would want to hear the truth and step in to help. But when I needed it most, three women showed up. First Eva, then Danielle, and finally Charlie. If we don't tell our own stories, we'll never take control of the narrative. I square my shoulders and look directly into the camera, feeling the terror of the last hour, the stress of the past week, and the fear of the past 10 years slipping off me, now nothing more than the faint whisper of a shadow. As you know, my husband comes from a very powerful family with unlimited resources. But what you don't know is that our marriage was a difficult one. For the cameras, he was charming and dynamic, but behind closed doors, he became violent, triggered without warning. The world saw us as a happy and committed team, but beneath the veneer, I was in crisis. Guarding my secrets, trying to do better, to be better, desperate to live up to the impossible standards my husband set for me. Terrified when I couldn't. Like many women in this situation, I was stuck in a cycle of abuse for years, afraid to anger him, afraid to speak up, afraid that if I did, no one would believe me. Living like that breaks a person down, one tiny piece at a time until you can't see the truth in anything or anyone. He'd isolated me from anyone I might have gone to for help. I'd tried before to leave him, to tell the truth of my marriage, but powerful men make powerful enemies, and no one wanted Rory Cook as an enemy. The only way out that I could see that didn't involve public scandal or a prolonged court battle was to simply disappear. But a plane crash, that was a tragic coincidence. I wasn't supposed to be on that plane to Puerto Rico. I'd planned to disappear in Canada. A last-minute scheduling change derailed everything. But then I met a woman at the airport willing to trade tickets with me. I think about the people still looking for Eva and deliver my line. Unfortunately, she perished instead of me. And I will be forever grateful to her for giving me the chance to escape. Tell us what you were escaping from. I imagine Rory somewhere called to the television to watch the resurrection of his dead wife, rage pounding through him as he stands helpless while I snatch his precious reputation and tear it to shreds. Almost from the beginning, I say, he would berate me for laughing too loud, for eating too much or too little, for missing his calls, for spending too long talking to one person at an event or not enough time talking to another. If I was lucky, that's all it would be, yelling and insults, followed by days of silence and icy glares. But about 2 years into the marriage, the yelling progressed to shoving, and shortly after that, to hitting. A photograph fills the screen behind me, an image of Rory and me walking on the beach in the Hamptons. It had first appeared in People magazine, then quickly became one of several stock images news outlets used when reporting on Rory's private life. This picture was taken last summer. You can only see what's in the frame, a couple walking on the beach holding hands. What you can't see is everything beneath it. How angry my husband was with me. How tightly he gripped my hand. So hard, my ring cut the inside of the finger next to it. My long sleeves hide bruises from the night before after I'd forgotten the name of an old friend of Rory's. You can't see the lump on the back of my head from where it slammed into the wall. Or the pounding headache I had. You can't see how lost I felt. How alone. I looked down at my hands. the fear and desperation I felt in that one captured moment, cascading over me once again. And how much I didn't want to do this. To have to recount every blow, every indignity, as a way to justify myself. Kate's voice is quiet in my ear. Why come forward now? You'd gotten away. You were set up in California. You were free. I was never free. First of all, I had no identity and no way of getting one. I had no money, no job. I was able to get temporary work with a catering company, which led to my image being posted on TMZ, forcing me to come forward. I look into the camera, keeping my gaze steady, and imagine I'm speaking directly to Eva. For a short time, we inhabited the same skin, the same life. I know things about her no one else will know, and that binds you to a person, a gossamer thin thread crossing time and space. Wherever I am, she will be too, and wherever she is, I hope it's far from here. But I also felt that I needed to honor the woman who died in my stead, I say. There are people out there who loved her, who might want to know what happened to her. They deserve to have closure as well. I pause for a moment, thinking about the scrap of paper I found at Eva's, still shoved in my pocket. I'm ready to step beyond the fear, I tell Kate. I want my life back. Mine. The one that belongs to me. My husband has stolen a lot from me. He's stolen my confidence. He's stolen my self-worth. And I don't think he deserves to steal anymore. From anyone. Across the studio, the digital clock flips from 1:59 to 2. 0 hours left. I'm free. Claire, New York City, 1 month after the crash. I've never been in the townhouse on Fifth Avenue when it was this empty. There was always someone here, cooking or cleaning, scheduling appointments, standing guard outside Rory's office. But in the wake of my CNN interview and the subsequent grand jury investigation into Rory's involvement in Maggie's death, everyone has been dismissed. The rooms are silent, and I feel like a ghost. Walking the same route I used to take in my middle-of-the-night wanderings. Perhaps I am one, returning to haunt the life I left behind and finding everything changed. At first, the story was slow to take shape while Rory's attorneys battled to uphold the non-disclosure agreement. But once he lost, a crash of information flooded the media, with something new released almost every day, the fight Rory and Maggie had the night she died, how it had ended with her unconscious at the bottom of the stairs, and Rory scrambling to save himself from what he believed he'd done. How Rory had driven straight to Charlie's apartment, only a few blocks away from his on the west side. At the time, she tried to help him. She believed the story he'd told, a deer in the road on his way back to the city, the car on the verge of going into a ditch. A close call that had him severely rattled. Until news of Maggie's death started to emerge. Charlie, who was young and in love with Rory, and had once hoped Rory would leave Maggie for her, began to grow alarmed. When she started asking questions, Rory's father paid her to keep quiet, and then slammed her with a non-disclosure agreement so steep, it guaranteed she'd stay that way. For years, she'd tried to leave it behind her, until the rumors of Rory's run for Senate surfaced. Charlie was no longer a scared 20-year-old. Like many, she'd grown tired of watching powerful men never being held accountable. Boys will be boys, evolving into an impenetrable armor, shielding them from blame. The media had a field day, revisiting the summer Maggie Moretti died, reprinting old articles with updated information, interviewing her friends again, and this time adding in Charlie and her relationship with Rory, which overlapped the one with Maggie by several months. Everyone wanting to know more about the love triangle, to look into every corner and see something new, to be the outlet that got the newest morsel to dish out via Twitter. I've tried to stay out of the spotlight, but Kate Lane was right. My first week back, I'd made the cover of People, my face turned in three-quarter profile, my hair returned to its original shade, and the headline, Resurrected. While most people were sympathetic, having harbored doubts about Rory's involvement in Maggie's death for years, there were others who attacked me viciously, questioning my character, calling me a gold digger, a vindictive wife bent on destroying all the Cook family had built, blaming me for the fact that the Cook Family Foundation was now under investigation by the New York Attorney General for allegations of misuse of charitable assets and improper self-dealing. Through the LLC documents, my attorneys have been able to shield me from legal jeopardy, and I'm free to leave the state. New York isn't home anymore. I can't wait to get back to California and away from this circus. I enter my office where stacks of boxes line the walls. Armed with a very specific list and a limited window of time fiercely negotiated by my attorneys, I'm here to get what belongs to me. My clothes, my jewelry, my personal items. My gaze falls on the photograph of my mother and Violet on the wall, and this time I lift it off its hook and place it with the other things I'm taking with me. I let my eyes linger on my sister's smile, the way the dimple creases her left cheek, the way the sun shines behind her hair as it blows in the wind, making it look like spun gold. The memories feel sweet when they come, instead of the sharp ache I've been running from for so many years. I pick up a small statue, 6 inches tall, an original Rodin that Rory bought last year, and think of how much money I could get if I sold it. But it's not on my list. Aside from my own things, all our joint assets are locked down. Though there's really very little I want or need in my new life in Berkeley. Kelly had helped me find an apartment. I'd called her a few days after my interview, after I'd met with my attorneys and begun the long process of unraveling everything I'd done. By that time, I was leading the news on every network and cable news show. "Holy shit, Eva," she'd said, and then caught herself. "Sorry, I guess I should call you Claire." I smiled and sat down on the bed in the hotel room my attorneys were paying for, exhausted from hours of depositions. We were only going to be there for a few more days, and then I'd have to return to New York to finish up. I imagined her on campus somewhere, her backpack heavy with books, pausing on one of the shady paths that crisscrossed campus to take my call. "I'm sorry I misled you." "No. I'm sorry the job I got you started this mess." It would have happened eventually, one way or another. The life I was trying to live would have been unsustainable. I cleared my throat. "Listen, you mentioned you could help me find a place to live. After all of this is finished, I'd really like to stay in Berkeley." "Let me make a few phone calls and get back to you," she said. The apartment was located on a narrow street that wound up the hill behind the football stadium. The top floor of a narrow wooden structure nestled in between the towering trees of Strawberry Canyon. The landlady, Mrs. Crespi, was a friend of Kelly's mother and was more than happy to rent it to me. She warned us that parking could be troublesome on game days and that the sound of the cannon they fired after touchdowns could be startling at first. It had about 40 wooden stairs, and when we reached the top, Mrs. Crespi opened the door and stepped aside so I could enter first. Not even 800 square feet. It was like a treehouse. Kelly huffed next to me and said, "You might want to think about grocery delivery. I can't imagine carrying anything heavier than a purse all the way up here." "I have 3 tenants, professional women like yourself," Mrs. Crespi said. "I charge $1,500 a month, but that includes all utilities. If you decide to take it, I'll need first and last for security deposit. And the furniture can stay since it's difficult to move things in and out of here. I can have it professionally cleaned if you like." My attorneys had negotiated a monthly stipend. Although it wasn't much, I'd have to sell all my jewelry and find a job, but I was looking forward to the chance to be on my own, to earn my own way. "That should work," I said, stepping into the living room and kitchen space. Even though I knew it was going to be small, the fact that nearly the entire west side of the room was glass made the apartment seem bigger. A sage green couch faced the window, with a small TV mounted on a stand next to the front door. Behind us, a tiny kitchen with a patch of counter space for food prep, a stove, and a refrigerator took up the back of the room. Beyond that was a short hallway leading toward a bathroom and a tiny bedroom. I walked to the window. A blanket of green treetops swooped down the hill, with the university buildings tucked in between them, glowing like half-buried treasures in the late afternoon light. Beyond that, San Francisco Bay shimmered, the sun casting the city skyline and bridge in the distance as a silhouette. "I love it," I said, turning to face Kelly and Mrs. Crespi. A smile illuminated Mrs. Crespi's wrinkled face. "I'm so glad." She opened the file she was holding and handed me a lease agreement. "You can move in whenever you're ready." I took the paperwork from her and grinned. "I'm ready now," I said, and turned back to the view again. "Do you want me to pack up everything in the bathroom, or do you want to go through the drawers yourself?" Petra stands in the doorway to my office, and I turn from the box I've been sorting through to face her. When I'd returned to New York, she had been the one to pick me up from the airport. She'd waited until we were safely in the back of the town car she'd hired before falling apart. "This feels like a dream," she said through her tears. "When I saw that the plane had crashed..." She trailed off and pressed her fingers to her eyes, taking a deep breath. "And then you show up on CNN and eviscerate that motherfucker." It turned out I hadn't copied her phone number down wrong. I had it disconnected, Petra had explained when I'd asked why it didn't work. "After I talked to you at the airport, I worried Rory might do some kind of reverse directory assistance and figure out who it belonged to, so I got a new one. But then the news." She shrugged, unable to continue, tears tumbling down her cheeks again. I closed the lid on one box and slid another one toward me. "Pack it all," I tell her now. "The lotions and makeup are expensive. I'd be stupid to throw them away." "I still think you should stay here," Petra says. "This is your home and you're entitled to it. Maybe not all the contents." She glances at the Rodin statue. "But you should fight for what's yours." "I don't want it," I say, turning back to the box and sealing it closed. "I don't need all this space." "It's not about the space," Petra argues. "It's about what belongs to you." "Then we'll sell it, and I'll get half." "I want you to stay in New York." I walk toward her and give her a hug. "I know," I say, pulling back. "But you know why I can't. I need to start over somewhere new." "You should come to California. The light, the air, they're different there. You'd love it." Petra looks skeptical. "I'd better finish that bathroom. We're almost out of time." She leaves, and I open the last box, sorting through it quickly, discarding most of it. The money from my jewelry will allow me time to explore my options in California. Maybe I'll keep working events with Kelly, or I'll go back to school. I imagine myself taking the BART into San Francisco, perhaps working at the museum there, going out to dinner with the friends I hope to finally make. After I'd finished the CNN interview, Agent Castro had taken me back to Eva's house to walk him through my time there. I wasn't sure what more I could tell him that he didn't already know. They'd submitted Eva's DNA to the NTSB and were waiting to see if it matched with any of the remains they'd recovered so far.
"It's possible we'll never know," he says. "They tell me there are any number of reasons why she might not have been in your seat. Maybe she traded with someone, or perhaps the impact of the crash caused her to get thrown from the wreckage and carried away with the current. If that's the case, we may never recover her body."
He shrugged and looked out the window, as if the answer to what happened to Eva might be out there somewhere, visible only to him. "What about the drug dealer?"
"Dex,"
Agent Castro said.
"Also known as Felix Argyros, or Fish. We have a lead on him up in Sacramento."
An agent passed through the living room carrying Eva's camping stove, bagged in a clear plastic evidence bag.
"She must have been so desperate to have chosen a life like this."
"I think Eva would argue that this life chose her,"
Agent Castro sighed.
"She was a hard person to know. I'm not really sure I ever had a good handle on her. But even though she ran, she still tried to do the right thing. What she left behind will be critical in indicting Fish." She sounds complicated, I said.
She was, but I liked her. I wish I could have done more for her.
I didn't say what I was thinking. That Eva didn't need anyone. She'd done just fine on her own. I pick up a pile of clothes and carry it into the living room, setting it alongside the rest of the things I'll be taking with me. I check the time. We only have about 30 more minutes. I hear Petra closing doors in the bathroom upstairs, muttering something to herself, and I smile. My work is mostly done. I walk down the hallway that leads to Rory's office and peek inside. It's been completely cleared out. His desk, Bruce's, even the books on the shelves are gone. All of it confiscated by the Attorney General. I cross over to the empty bookshelves, reaching up and engaging the button, and the drawer below opens. As I suspected, it's empty. I hear someone unlocking the front door, and I straighten up, feeling guilty because I'm not supposed to be in here. But it's only Danielle. She stops in the doorway when she sees me. Looking for ghosts? She asks. I smile. Something like that? Danielle had been waiting for me when I first returned to the townhouse. She'd led me into the kitchen and made me a cup of tea. When we'd settled across from each other at the center island, I finally asked the question that had been nagging at me since her first message. How did you know where to find me? She gave a small, sad smile. Eva was a friend of my mom's. She took a tentative sip of her tea and told me a story of an unlikely friendship between two women, one who'd believed she didn't deserve to be loved, and the other who'd tried so hard to love her anyways. Although I only met her briefly, there was something furtive about her. She had an edge that felt dangerous. Danielle set her cup down on the island and traced a swirl of marble with her finger. But my mother was devoted to her. Swore that Eva was a good person who needed to know someone believed in her. Danielle shrugged. But that doesn't explain how you knew to call me on her phone. She was at my mother's house in New Jersey in the night before the Detroit trip. She must have eavesdropped on a conversation I had with my mom because afterward I caught her Googling photos of you. I was worried she'd try to target you somehow. Danielle shook her head as though the thought embarrassed her. How's your mom doing? Danielle looked toward the living room where the sun streamed through the tall windows, laying patches of light on the hardwood floor. Not well, she said. It's been hard for her to recognize that Eva's really gone. That if Eva had just followed the plan they'd agreed upon and returned to Berkeley, she'd be alive. I took a sip of hot chamomile tea, letting the flavor bloom in my mouth. Knowing I could never tell Danielle or her mother about what I believed really happened to Eva. I would leave it up to Eva to reach out, if and when she ever wanted to. Eva Googling me couldn't have been enough for you to know where to look. It was the video, she said. There you were, in Eva's hometown, with hair similar to Eva's and... She trailed off. I took a chance, looked up Eva's number on my mom's phone, and hoped you'd answer when I called. Danielle bent her head down, turning her cup slowly in her hands. When she looked up again, her eyes were wet with tears. I had to do something after all those years of staying silent. I'm so, so sorry I didn't do more to help you. She let out a shuddering breath. I thought that by keeping you on task, on schedule, I could protect you. If I worked hard enough, maybe he wouldn't have a reason to be angry. I reached across the island and put my hand on top of hers. You helped me when it mattered most. More than I ever could have hoped for. She squeezed my hand. A silent apology. Late, but not too late. The faint sound of a siren travels through the thick glass of Rory's office window. I look around the room, trying to picture the afternoon of Danielle's recording. And where she might have dropped her phone in order to catch it. One last question, I say. How did you know to record that particular conversation? Did you know what they'd be talking about? Danielle steps into the room and runs her fingers across the back of one of the chairs. I'd just seen the video of you at the A's event.
And even though Mr. Cook never said anything to me about it, his sudden trip to Oakland made me believe he had seen it too. I was hoping to record a conversation about their plans to find you, to give you an idea of where and how they'd be looking. I had no idea I'd end up with something so much better. It was an incredibly brave and stupid thing to do. Danielle grins.
That's exactly what my mom said.
She checks her watch. We'd better finish. Time's almost up. I close the drawer with a quiet click and follow Danielle into the living room where we pack the last of my things. Petra enters the room just as I'm zipping my bag closed.
Ready?
She asks us. I give the room one last look. The thick rugs, the expensive furniture, all of it meaningless to me now. And I smile at them both. Ready, I say.
Epilogue. John F. Kennedy Airport, New York. Tuesday, February 22nd. The day of the crash. I hunch down on the ground next to the jetway, picking up the scattered items from Claire's purse. My only view, the shoes of the people in line around me, and shove it all back inside, save my prepaid phone. That I hold up to my ear. My plan is simple. First, I'll ease sideways, as if I need to lean against the wall for balance. Then, I'll turn away from the struggling line of travelers, obedient and forward-facing. After that, it will be a simple matter of walking with purpose in a new direction. I'm just about to speak into the silent phone, to launch into another fake conversation, maybe something urgent requiring a little space, a little privacy. When someone says, "Ma'am, are you okay?" The voice comes from behind me, behind the crowd of travelers that block my view. Another gate agent materializes and I slowly rise to a stand, my knees popping. I dropped my purse, I explain, pulling it back onto my shoulder, feeling the slight tremor of a closing door, a missed opportunity. "Since you're scanned onto the flight, I'm going to need you to stay in line," the gate agent says. I reclaim my spot in front of the women who were complaining about the wait, the slope of the jetway pulling me forward toward the plane. Somewhere, Claire is already in the air, flying toward California. And I feel a stab of guilt. Not for the lies I told, but perhaps I should have at least warned her to be careful. As the line to board the plane inches forward, I wonder if I'd met Claire under different circumstances, whether we might have been friends. It feels wrong to be the last person to speak to her before she disappears, to be the only person in the world who knows what happened to her and still not know anything of substance about her. Who she loves, what matters to her, or what she believes in when she needs to believe in something. The specifics of the circumstances that have narrowed down to only this one outrageous option. We have one thing in common. Each of us is desperate enough to take the risk, to turn our backs on who the world demands we be. It isn't just what has been done to each of us, by Dex, by Claire's husband. It's a system that tells women we are unreliable and then expendable, that our truths don't matter when set side by side with a man's. I try to clear my mind, to focus on what will come next for me. Liz will worry when I don't call as promised, but it has to be this way. When Castro arrives on her doorstep, Liz needs to be able to say with confidence that I returned to do the right thing. Perhaps a few months from now, Liz might get a small package in the mail. A Christmas ornament, with no card, no return address, from the ripe vineyards of Italy, or the crowded streets of Mumbai. And she'll know that I'm sorry, that I'm happy, that I've finally forgiven myself. As soon as I board, I'm going to ask to have my aisle seat changed to a window. I want to view the world, its wide vista expanding in a graceful arc below me, and imagine myself in it, my true self, the person Liz showed me I can be. I hope that when the plane takes off, we'll fly straight into the sun, The light so bright it will burn away the last vestiges of everything and everyone I'm leaving behind. That it will carry me forward, higher than I've ever been, above the fear and the lies, tearing away a page filled with mistakes, the fragments scattering behind me like confetti. I'll create a new life built from the scraps of memory, some true, some the wished-for imaginings of a little girl who never found her place, constructed with luck and wide beams of gratitude holding it all together. Maybe someday I'll dream of my life in Berkeley, not the one I lived, with its dark corners and deceitful shadows, but the one I conjured up years ago, in a narrow bed above a dusty church in San Francisco. I'll visit again the light-dappled trails of Strawberry Canyon, high above the old stadium, with its view of a city skyline that seems to rise straight out of the bay. In my mind, I'll walk along campus paths that wind among the redwoods, smell the damp bark and moss soft beneath my feet, listen to the stream tumble and jump across the rocks. Ahead of me, the line starts moving again, space opening up between people, allowing me to breathe easier. Whatever was wrong has been fixed, and I can feel the people around me relax, anticipating the vacation that waits for them on the other side of the 4-hour flight south. As I make my way down the jetway, I feel as if I'm shedding my old self, piece by piece, growing lighter the closer I get to the plane. Pretty soon, I might not weigh anything at all. A laugh bubbles up, light and crisp, carrying none of the debris it usually does. In this moment, I have all I ever wanted. And for the first time, for the only time, it's enough. I hitch Claire's purse tighter over my shoulder and touch the outside of the airplane as I step over the threshold. For luck. And don't look back.
This has been an Audible Studios production of The Last Flight, a novel written by Julie Clark, performed by Christine Vam and Lauren Fortgang. Executive producers Rena Ayer and Mike Charzuk. Producer Thomas Mann. Copyright 2020 by Julie Clark. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.